Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Rebecca Shinsky here with Vanessa Diaz while Jeff is on vacation. We're recording, or actually, Jeff's not on vacation. He's working. I don't want to sell him short.
I was like, ooh, we're doing a code.
Vacation is the new code for business meetings.
I was like, he's definitely not on vacation. You know
he's
what? I'm wrong
not.
With it.
I was like, Jeff is out. What is Jeff doing? I don't know.
Where in the world is Jeff right now?
There's a fun one. But I'm here with you, Vanessa. I'm delighted that you're here with me today. And this is a talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. So I guess that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, let's do that. Why not?
Yeah, we were just off mic talking about the various woes of spring, mostly the pollen, the disruption to the sleep cycle. If that last one is relevant to you, I covered books about sleep and rest in the latest edition of Better Living Through Books, which is my newsletter on Substack about lifestyle nonfiction, all the things that we read to make our lives better. I'm doing a little bit of everything over there. It's been fun so far. Just launched it in January, and you can find it at betterlivingthroughbooks.substack.com, or we'll put a link in the show notes. And also opportunities for folks to request, you know, personal recommendations or installments of the newsletter about specific topics. Lifestyle nonfiction covers a wide range of things. So feel free to, you know, check me out over there. It's free. There's also a bonus, you know, paid subscription option. So you can join me there. And I would love to, you know, have more folks. We're having a good time. Better Living Through Books. It's the Book Riot way. Let's see. Before we get into the news, also just want to mention to y'all that if you are, I don't know, in charge of your book club or regularly on the hook for picking a book for your book club, we have some resources that can help you out. Namely, it's another newsletter because that's what we're good at. It's called In the Club. It delivers recommendations for the best books to talk about with your book clubs, ranging from buzzy new releases to throwbacks. The books that they highlight in the newsletter will drive your book club discussions, give you interesting things to talk about, and also we share book club friendly recipes and bookish updates from all over. Paid subscribers get even more recommendations and community features. So we'll keep you well met, well read, and well fed. I don't know who wrote that copy, but my hat is off to them. Good job.
It's a combination of Jen and moi. Fun fact, I used to write that newsletter. Now the wonderfully talented Erica Ezzafetti does, and it is a good time. So.
And so if you want to sign up for that, you can visit bookriot.com/in the club. That's bookriot.com/in the club. We'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Before we get into the news, let's take a quick ad break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So this could be us as an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, Vanessa. We have like a variety pack of stuff. It was a pretty light bookish news week. So I think we're going to talk about the news. We're going to talk about things that we've been reading lately. Who knows what else is going to happen? The wheels might come off a little bit. We've both been writing our faces off this week. So
the wheels are not to be found, and that's okay.
Well, you know, it's just good to be honest about that right up front.
It is.
But let's start with adaptation news, because this is a shared wheelhouse of yours and mine.
Yes.
News. I think the news came out when the adaptation was sold, but this is the first that I've seen of casting and release information. So an adaptation of Colson Whitehead's novel, The Nickel Boys, is coming out supposedly later this year. It's going to be directed by Ramel Ross. Of course, based on Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize winning novel, coming out from MGM's Orion Pictures, and Oscar nominee Ingenue Ellis from King Richard will be starring in it alongside Hamish Linklater, Fred Heschinger, Brandon Wilson, and Ethan Harise. I'm really interested in this. This is a tough book. Did you read The Nickel Boys? Is this in your... Okay. I hear that oof.
Yeah. I've only read half of it, and it's... I'm going to finish it. It was just a time. I want to say I was reading this, I mean, deep in like... whatever. There's been many dark times in the last 4 years, but it was a really difficult time. And that, I mean, it was phenomenal, the half that I got through, but my soul needed a break. So I'm really interested to see how this translates to page.
That is very real. It's, for those of you who haven't read it or you need a refresher, it's based on a true story about a Florida reform school that abused and killed thousands of children over more than a century that it was in operation. The book is about a young boy named Elwood Curtis. He's a Black boy growing up in the 60s. It's Tallahassee, Florida. All of the things that you're assuming about that are correct. And Elwood is sentenced to this juvenile reformatory. It's called the Nickel Academy, and finds himself trapped in just increasingly horrific situations, watching his peers also experience increasingly horrific things. It is Whitehead's smallest book. I think it's his best. Packs a really powerful punch, and this is just not going to be easy to watch. Not that the Underground Railroad was easy to watch either, and sure. Barry Jenkins' adaptation of that for Prime Video was really excellent. So I'm curious about, really primarily, where do you see an adaptation like this, you know, sitting in the world of movies, sitting in the world of things that are adapted? How do you think we're going to be talking about this as it comes out?
Yeah, that's the part I'm trying to suss out for myself, because honestly, the way this reads, it is straight up horror. Like, it's, you know, horror obviously being like a thing that is subjective and it's more a mood than a genre. But for all the reasons that you just communicated, like, I can't decide exactly where this film is going to end up kind of landing as far as the way that it's going to be marketed and billed, because it is such a heavy, heavy subject matter that does also feel weirdly timely, and that we're having a lot of discussions between the discovery of the residential schools in Canada, or even this like new adaptation on Netflix right now about the like troubled teen industry kind of thing.
Yes.
About like, hey, all these schools that we've been putting children in since the dawn of time have this really dark underlying abuse about them that I think it's going to be a really important adaptation, but I know I have to gird my loins to watch it, and I can't figure out where it's going to land for people, but it's so exciting to see it cast.
Horror is that's a really interesting word to attach to it, because it certainly is an accurate description of what happens in this story. I don't think it's horror in the way of like Get Out or Nope, where there's that creeping realization of what's going on. The book does have the creeping realization of what's going on, but there it lacks a I don't know, there's that like sort of not zany, Jordan Peele's not zany, but there's like a glimmer in Jordan Peele's eye, you know, when he's telling these kind of stories, and this is not that. Whitehead knows that, everybody affiliated with the film knows that. The closest analogy I've got to it, and it might be recency bias because I just saw it a month or so ago, but the Zone of Interest.
Exactly. I was like, what about
Zone is that what you were thinking about?
Yeah.
Say more about that.
Yeah, it's just, again, the just implicit understanding that like humanity in and of itself is often horrifying if it's not, you know, horror, and the commentary that it has on I can't even like think of the accurate words to describe it, but it's just something about going, hey, take a look at the past, because it may not be the same, but it was, what's that quote, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes sort of thing. Is, I think, a lesson that this book is, it teaches quite loudly and strongly. And for reasons of that film as well, I'm thinking a lot about where that could possibly be placed.
Yeah, for folks who haven't seen it, I know Jeff and I talked about it a little bit when we talked about adapted screenplays, because, of course, it's based on Martin Amis's novel of the same name. But the Zone of Interest is set just outside of the Auschwitz concentration camp during the Holocaust, about the man who runs the camp, like the commandant in Hitler's military, and his family, who are just like trying to live what they imagine to be a beautiful life. He's climbing the ladder in the shadow of this horrible thing, and he's climbing it by doing these horrible things, by perpetuating horrible acts and strategically figuring out how to get better at them. And we see all of this kind of through his eyes, through his family's life. We never go into the camp, though you know what's happening. And I was thinking about the Nickel Boys and how like there's like a shed or an old building where a lot of the torture takes place, and you are mostly, we are with the characters mostly outside of that building where they can hear what's happening in it. And I think those scenes will be similar, but that's the closest film analogy I have for it. And like Zone of Interest was a powerful experience, but definitely a movie going project. Like it's one, you know, you undertake that when it's like, I'm a person who cares about history and film, not like I'm going to go have a good fun afternoon at the movies. And I'm really interested and glad to see Hollywood taking these kinds of stories seriously, but I will be I'll be paying a lot of attention to how this is marketed.
Oh, me too. Definitely.
So we will keep our eyes on that. I'm sure that we will be discussing this in detail here on the Book Riot podcast. It's Colson Whitehead and an adaptation. Come on.
It's like the white hot center. Yeah, no, for sure.
Truly. In happier things for us to discuss, but still, you know, a realm of serious issues. In fact, all of these today are pretty serious, but DC Comics is going to be honoring, I don't know what that word is. DC Comics is going to be honoring Rachel Pollack, who died last year. She was the writer of the first comic to introduce a trans superhero. Coagula appeared in the 1993 issue of Doom Patrol, Doom Patrol number 70. And also appeared in Vertigo Visions, The Geek, which was a lesser known work that featured some of their work. DC Comics does a big Pride celebration every year. I assume this will be coming out in June. It's a lineup of LGBTQ plus content of all kinds. And this year it's a 96-page special edition, DC Pride, a celebration of Rachel Pollack. I didn't know anything about this until this story came across my threshold this week. And I was really surprised to learn that it was 1993. Like, I went back and Googled, when did Ellen come out on television?
Ooh, that's an interesting marker.
It was, right? And it was after that. Like, it was, and that was such a big deal. Like, obviously, it's not the only big, you know, mainstream pop culture moment for queer culture, but that was a really, really big deal. And that DC Comics was just incorporating a trans superhero into their universe without making it like a big controversial deal. Mm-hmm. I thought was really remarkable. So I was glad to read this piece from them about by Samantha Riedel about Pollack's work.
I definitely had no idea that this person was writing comics in general, just being a thing that for, you know, we've known for a long time, just really lack accurate representation mm-hmm. among women and definitely in queer. I'm glad that we're seeing a lot of these more queer initiatives, but yeah, the fact that it was in the 90s was super surprising to me, and I'm happy they're focusing on it. I would also like to point out that Rachel Pollack was a tarot expert.
Yeah.
Which I just think is, activism, comics pioneer, tarot expert. It's like a really cool deck. There's been like a cool, I think like a fundraising effort to try to get more of her work kind of reprinted. Mm-hmm. And by the time I was looking at this yesterday, it had already surpassed its $10,000 goal, which was really great.
Yeah. When I was reading this earlier this week, I was thinking, Rachel Pollack, that name sounds really familiar. And then I have a, you know, set of books about tarot. And I was like, wait.
That's right.
78 Degrees of Wisdom. That's her. What a fascinating real person who contained multitudes. They are going to be relaunching one of her decks and the accompanying guidebook. So if you're listening to this and you're into tarot, especially if, like me, you knew her tarot book, because it's one of, like, if you want to just learn the basics of tarot and, like, what is this all about, it is one of the ones that people will recommend. And I was like, oh, what a fascinating career. So Rachel Pollack continues, her efforts continue to succeed even beyond her death. And what a cool person.
Super cool.
All right. Vanessa, now we have to turn to book banning news.
We do. It's time. When is it? Where
would
time?
You? That's true. Where would you like to start?
I want to start with the Illinois news, as my voice crackles with anticipation here. But just so this was reported on by our owner, Kelly Jensen, who does so much of the heavy lifting on our censorship coverage. And it's specifically about a suburban Illinois school district canceling the Rebecca Cottle Awards, which were a really cool thing. They began in 1988, and it was a way for 4th through 8th grade students across the state to basically vote on books that were nominated and honored by this award. It was a really coveted honor, just based on like literary excellence and then how the books themselves appealed to the middle-aged reading demographic, which doesn't sound like a bad thing, right? Like, what could you find wrong with this? Except that somebody on the school board was like, well, what if it looks to me like these might be politically leaning left. And so even though folks were pretty adamant about, like, the original consensus seemed to be that, like, no, this should go on, when the vote actually came down, they still elected to go ahead and just get rid of it in this specific school district.
Yeah.
Which is layers of frustrating, because it very much seems like it was just like, I don't want to fight with this guy people who agree, so let's just stop, which is not like a new piece of information, but it's still incredibly frustrating that it's coming for something like a book award. And, you know, pointing out the obvious, that the reason so many of these books are quote unquote left leaning is because they're progressive. Like, it's kids want to see themselves in books. And, you know, again, tale as old as time, but here we are.
The dude who kicked this off, the villain of our story, is named John Ruggles. He noted that he has not read all three of the books that were up for voting, because of course he has not. They never have. But he has read one that his son brought home, and he found it to be very upsetting. It was the kids' version of Ibram X. Kendi Stamped mm-hmm. from the Beginning. It's called Stamped for Kids, Racism, Anti-Racism. And you, no surprise there, it is always the books that address queer issues and yeah. issues of race and racism that these folks are coming for, that acknowledge the truth of our world. And that, like, this should not be a progressive concept, but it's somehow... has become one. The one thing that I noted here that John Ruggles gets right is he's like, I'm concerned that there might be a political or cultural angle to the program, and he's all for celebrating things but believes that they should be neutral. And I just have some news, I guess, for John Ruggles that books have never been neutral, and so he is quite correct that there's a political and cultural angle to it. This is a real loss for these kids. You know, like, there's a realm of this where you're like, it's one book award, the kids will be fine. But this is death of a thousand cuts. Mm-hmm. These folks are fighting a war of attrition. And like you were saying, a lot of it does come down to either people not having the time, the resources, or the energy to fight back, especially when the rhetoric from the right is increasingly violent, and you really do stand the risk of being harassed and threatened if you try to fight back against them. It's a small school district. There aren't a whole lot of kids, you know, in the big picture of the whole state of Illinois being impacted by this, but that doesn't matter. This shouldn't happen anywhere. Would like to have seen these board members do their jobs and stand up for it. I'll need to do a little further Googling about whether this is an elected or an appointed school board. But Kelly did leave information about the school board members' contact info. Yep. Their next meeting is April 8th. So you can contact the members of the board using this contact info that's in the piece. We'll drop a link in the show notes and let them know what you think about this. This is one of those predictable, disappointing, like, of course, this is the case you're making kinds of stories about book banning. And we continue to talk about those here because this is the story. Most of these stories are not, it's not Fahrenheit 451. It is not like the scene from Footloose or somebody dumping a bunch of books into a bit, you know, a big can, into a garbage can and setting them on fire. Like, that is not typically happening. It's, you know, one of the ways I think that folks are getting away with this is that each instance might not sound so bad by itself, but they add up to something that is really horrifying and that we should not be standing for. So good people of Illinois, call your reps, call these school board members. May your efforts succeed. I just hope there's nothing political or cultural about books, Vanessa.
Sit down. Take several seats. It's just... ugh. And then now that I'm fired up about that, we have another ridiculous...
Yes. Let's take an ad break, give ourselves like a deep breath here, and then we'll get into what's happening here in my home state of Virginia.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee. So I am super excited about this one. It has what sounds like a really interesting, unique magic system. It is a medical magic system, and the world is based in a Vietnam-inspired fantasy world. And it follows Nika, who is what you call a blood carver. And blood carvers are these beings who can alter human biology with a single touch. Now, to people like Thumas, she is a monster who can be traded for gold. So one day she gets caught and she's forced to heal the last witness to a high profile murder. And all signs in her investigation point to an alluring physician's aide, Cochin. But then she discovers Cochin is not who he says he is. And she's suddenly faced with a greater evil lurking in the city. Now her only chance to survive lies in a choice. She can become the monster the city fears or risk the future of her kind. Amazing. I'm so excited. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to The Last Blood Carver by Vanessa Lee for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hiro to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hiro's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com. And catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
All right, Virginia. This is one that sounds like a headline from The Onion, but we can't even be glib about it because this is like one of the logical ends at the bottom of a stupid slippery slope. In Floyd County, Virginia, the public schools have launched a one division, one book community reading project. This year, they were planning to read Wish Tree by Catherine Applegate, and the book has been pulled from the program. Because it is about a monoecious red oak tree. And if it's been a while since you took biology, monoecious means the tree has both male and female reproductive parts. It can pollinate and flower simultaneously. I'm not familiar with Wish Tree. This piece in PW by Natalie Opdebeek cites that in the book, the tree introduces itself and claims an identity that is both female and male, and it responds to multiple pronouns. The tree even tells the reader, call me she, call me he, anything will work. This piece notes very helpfully that trees have four primary systems of reproduction. And this is where we are now. Folks are mad about how actual biology of trees works, and their ideology is so flimsy that we can't even talk about the fact that trees have this kind of reproductive system. I was thinking, like, wait until they find out about those alligators.
Exactly. The alligators, like, sea anemone, whatever. Like, these are, like, things that we learned and were very, like, excited to learn when you were, like, a kid learning basic biology. Like, oh, did you know? You know, and it's, like, we're mad about plants. We're mad about plants, my dude.
And this is all of, again, this is one person who has, you know, stoked this problem. Her name is Jody Farmer. Her kids attend a private Christian academy. So her kids don't even go to these public schools, but she took to Facebook to inform Floyd County residents about the reference to gender. She challenged Wish Tree's non-binary account of the Oaks identity, calling the book indoctrination at its finest. And so the school district now, in response to, I don't even know what to call this, in response to this thing stirred up by a person whose children are not even impacted, has decided to cancel the program. And their email to the families in the school district said, "We understand and respect the concerns raised by members of the community regarding certain material within the selected book. And after careful consideration, we decided to suspend the one division, one book reading event. Families are welcome to continue reading the book on their own, but schools will not be hosting any corresponding activities." Now, this could have gone the other way. Why can't the schools continue to host these activities, especially since Jody Farmer's kids don't even go to this school? And folks could opt their kids out if they don't want them to learn about how trees work. You know, we don't have the ins and outs of this school board meeting, but I suspect that this is one of those cases that you were just talking about of, like, let's just not deal with it. We don't want to deal with this crackpot on Facebook. Let's just not go to the trouble. But it's that kind of giving in that's so, it's really understandable. I get it why people do not want to have to deal with that. And also just terrible to see. I was like, I feel like I had every feeling possible when I read this.
Yeah, like, I am deeply a person who understands the fatigue that, like, you said, comes with dealing with these kinds of decisions. And I don't want to, like, minimize that, especially for people who've been doing and are like on the front lines of that kind of work, whether you're in education or in librarianship or, you know, what have you. But there's also a piece of me that's like, you have a responsibility to these children. And if you are mm-hmm. in a position to like make that call, sometimes you just gotta. And I, again, I don't want to diminish the like deep sigh of exhaustion that must like come with those kinds of decisions. But something like this, especially when, you know, part of the argument for like why people need to just hush about queerness is like, hey, there's examples of this sort of thing in like literal biology, in plants, in etc. Like, let's just maybe pay attention to science and just take people's identity for what they say. And now that very thing is the thing that's being used to discredit like an entire program from a student, from a parent of a student mm-hmm. who doesn't even go, she doesn't even go here. So I just, again, I'm very empathetic to that yes. exhaustion. I don't want to make it sound like I have no heart for this, but it's like, at some point, is it just a giant collective giving up? Like you said, death of a thousand cuts. And now here we are doing not well by LGBTQ people or like just marginalized folks in general because we all got tired. And that's hard. That's hard to sit with.
It is. It's tough. Yeah. The author, Catherine Applegate, says in response to this that the irony is that Wishtree is about community and kindness yep. and tolerance. She wrote it in response to the othering of whole communities of immigrants mm-hmm. and people of color in the mid-2010s. The book originally came out in 2017. And in the documentary short, The ABCs of Book Banning, which was nominated for an Oscar this year in that category, you can see a young girl reading a passage from it. The book has been celebrated for its religious and cultural diversity. So yeah. Even if Jodie Farmer had not come with her complaints about monoecious oak trees, I think, you know, this is a book that is probably on the Moms for Liberty list and that people are looking out for. It's not even ironic at this point that they are banning books about community and kindness and tolerance. It's the point of it.
Yeah.
And so, again, we're going to keep mentioning these things because they keep happening and we have got to talk about them and fight them until we stop them. Floyd County Public Schools' next school board meeting is also April 8th. Catherine Applegate notes in this response to PW, she says, maybe I'll stop by and say hi. So if you're looking, you know, if you're going to be calling into Illinois, you might as well call or send some emails to my neighbors in Floyd County, Virginia, and let them know how you feel about this. I feel like the very least a school board could do is be like, she doesn't even go here.
No, really. Like, she doesn't even know here. She just has a lot of feelings. Like, go have your feelings by yourself at your private little school. Like, I just get so annoyed. Like, this kind of thing.
Right. You know, members of the community. Right. I'm a member of a community that does all kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's, you know, part of living in a pluralistic society. But that's a lecture for another day.
Indeed.
Let's take a turn to something promising. Why don't you tell me about the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 honorees?
I'm always so impressed by these folks because I'm like trying to think of what I was doing with myself when I was under 35. Heck, what I'm doing over 35. But the National Book Foundation announced its 5 Under 35 honorees for 2024, full of some super talented folks with a bunch of books that, of course, I've been meaning to read for some time. Each of the honorees are going to be honored at the 5 Under 35 ceremony on Thursday, May 9th at the Brooklyn Museum. They get a $1,000 prize that's funded by the Amazon Literary Partnership. And I don't know if, have you read any of these books? I haven't.
But I have not.
Oh, so yeah no. Give us the nominees then, which yes, are Antonia Ingris for Sirens and Muses. Mm-hmm. We have Maya Binyam for Hangman. We have Zain Khalid for A Brother Alive. We have Tyreek White for We Are a Haunting. And lastly, Jenny Tingui Zhang for Four Treasures of the Sky. I think I own four of these, but have not read them yet. Very exciting pieces of fiction, though, and they're all so different. And
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, We Are a Haunting is one that I remember coming up over and over last year and thinking, like, I need to put that on my stack. So I think that's probably the one that I'll pick up first. When I wrote about this for Today in Books earlier this week, I learned for the first time, probably because I just have not absorbed it in all the previous years that I've read about this program, that the way 5 Under 35 works through the National Book Foundation is that each honoree is selected by a previous National Book Foundation honoree of some kind. Some of them were five under 35 winners. Some of them have won national book awards. And so it's like each year, the National Book Foundation reaches out to five people that have won something from it in the past. And each of them picks a debut novelist. And like the deal is they have to have only had one book published or one work of fiction published. It has to have been within like the last couple of years. And then the idea is within the past 5 years. And the idea is to like set them up to leave a lasting impression on the literary landscape. But I love that like pay it forward arrangement of it. It's really cool to think about like of all the ways that you could put together awards like this. Usually it's like the board members at a foundation or some subcommittee of people or donors or, you know, reader's choice voting. But for something like this to be like, you know, kind of selected by members of the community, I think is really cool. And it's one of the, I guess, outlier instances. Like when the National Book Awards come out, I'm typically railing against like, why are the judges always like MFA teachers who pick MFA type books that aren't actually going to be widely read, when getting books to be more widely read is part of the National Book Foundation's mission. But I think this is a great case for letting it be a little inside baseball, letting folks who have had success in the National Book Foundation and in the broader literary landscape look at people that they want to uplift and give a spotlight to. So I was really excited to see that. And I just, you know, I love that I'm no longer worried when a list comes out like this of like, oh my God, is it all going to be white people?
Yeah, this is
we've got
overwhelmingly not, which is so wonderful to see.
It's very cool. So we'll have, of course, links to this and everything else in the show notes. But at the National Book Foundation's website, you can read comments from the past National Book honorees who selected these folks and learn a little bit more about how these books and these new 535 honorees were picked. Pretty cool. I like that. I just really like that setup a lot.
Me too.
All right, Vanessa, you want to just talk about some books?
Let's do
for
that.
A little bit?
I would love that.
Yeah, we've kept the wheels on for half an hour. We don't have to talk about any more news. What have you been reading lately? Let's go into Front List Foyer.
I've actually, for the longest part of this year, was in kind of a deep slump, and I started to go back to reading some kind of like thrillery kind of stuff, or like at least mystery, because that tends to be what pulls me out. So I picked up actually one. Everybody knows this one at this point, but it's The Hunter by Tana French.
Oh, yeah.
It is not what I would call like a fast read. It is quite the chonker. I am listening to it on like 1.5 speed, and I think I still have 7 of like 15 hours left to go on this thing. But it reminds me of The Witch Elm as far as pacing, where you're just getting these like slow little revelations, and there's just this constant sense of like, ugh, something bad's going to happen with this one. And it's set in like rural Ireland, which I don't know that I've ever read a book that was set in the country. It kind of gave me like Jane Harper vibes as far as feeling very
interesting.
I don't know, dry, even though it's Ireland. Like there's just something about place that's really speaking to me in this book. So yeah, really, really enjoying that new Tana French. And then in a very different direction, I'm reading Oye by Melissa Mogollon, which I will hopefully be talking about on the All the Books podcast soon. But it's the structure feels like a phone call. And I guess it is, because it's actually a teenage girl in, I think, Miami, who is talking to her sister who's away at college about like the family. They're Colombian.
Oh,
and that high schooler is trying, like her like lot in life right now is to convince her grandma to evacuate because there is a hurricane warning. And it's not like, oh, it might hit. It's like, it's going to hit. Abuela, we need to leave this house like right now. And the grandmother doesn't want to leave and is really like digging her heels in. And what she hasn't told anybody, this is like not a spoiler, it's all in the copy, is that she's just been diagnosed with a really aggressive form of cancer. Okay. So she's just like reluctant to leave her home. But the structure of it sometimes feels like I'm watching a telenovela, because it's like both gossipy and she's like, oh, our grandma, like, why won't she go? And like, but you're also learning a lot about that woman and watching their bond deepen. I have been looking for someone to write this kind of book as a person who obviously is like Latina, and I just something that captures that vibe. Like I've read plenty of like soapy romance and I love that, but something that feels a little more like, oh, hey, someone calling you to give you that chisme. And that's what this feels like. It's brilliant so far. And I hope it, you know, lands the way I think it's gonna, but I think this one's going to be one people talk about a lot.
That sounds great. Will you spell that title if we have folks that are just going to like go straight to their
yes.
book vendor of choice instead of hitting the show notes so that they know how to find it?
Yeah. So it's literally a one word title, Oye, which is kind of like, hey, you know, and it's O-Y-E. Mm-hmm. So Oye. Yeah,
okay.
Real simple.
Cool.
Which Thank is a word you will hear us say all the time. It's such a good title. Sounds great. Yeah.
I bet that's great on audio, that like phone call construction.
I'm actually waiting for the audio, like someone to either give me the advanced copy, or because that's how I intended to read this one, and it just hasn't made its way, because I think it's going to translate beautifully in audio. So I agree. And if I get it, I will happily flip formats, because it's one that sounds like a
Yeah, I will be keeping my eyes and ears out for that one. We're always on the hunt for unique audiobook experiences. All right. Anything else? I have a pile of front list, so keep going if you've got them.
Oh my gosh, this is like so Vanessa Corner, but I just don't care. I just finished The Tower by Flora Carr. It came out earlier this month. It is a debut. This is one of those rare opportunities where someone gives me the time to sit here and talk about like Tudor Stuart stuff. But
be my guest.
The book is about Mary Queen of Scots, but it's specifically focused on the 11 months where she was imprisoned in Lochleven Castle. And like, you know, as the reader, that she is headed towards like a not great ending. Like, we know that eventually she's going to be convicted, whether, you know, justifiably or not, is up for history debate, but of plotting to assassinate Queen Elizabeth. So, you know, she's getting her head lopped off at the end. But you're watching her, who's pregnant in this tower and surrounded only by her like ladies and like her chambermaids, basically, try to figure out like what's going on and how she's supposed to survive after everything that she's gone through. And it takes a lot of prowess to me to create a book about this like specific space that we really know nothing about, that you know the ending to, and still make you that invested in the characters. You get like the story from not just Mary's perspective, but from the other women that are like attending to her, and that weird dynamic of them having to essentially still treat her like royalty and like dress her and wait on her and hand and foot and like clean out her chamber pot when like she's been labeled a traitor and is trash to everybody. Wild. But like she still has that class rank. And then you get to know the inner workings of each of their minds. There's like a queer romance angle that's like thrown in there. It's just such an it's like a character study. And it was so richly brought to life about a thing again that you're like, I know where this is going. No, you don't. Like, and so I will rave about that book any chance I get, because I loved every page of it.
Your multitudes are really on display.
They really are.
In this trio of like, books.
This is going to be fun. Yeah, that's kind of me. If the only thing we're missing is like a book about witches or mythology, which I don't think I've read anything front list, or I would absolutely shove that in here right now.
What a great variety.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that, would you say The Tower, is it something that you could go into if you don't have a lot of knowledge yes. about Mary Queen of Scots and Tudor yeah. stuff?
Okay. So the book actually does reflect, like it actually gives you, if you want to hear me talk about this entirely too much, you can go to the recent episode of all the books where I talked about it, because I do give like a mini history lesson. But the story in flashbacks and in ways that don't feel too obvious or expository tells you how she got there. Okay. So you will learn like how she came to power, like, I mean, yeah, her story, I think, is endlessly fascinating. She made a lot of wrong choices, but a lot of really terrible stuff happened to her, too, because, you know, women mm-hmm. And rights and misogyny. But yeah, it gives you like the lay of like how she got from being whisked off to a convent in France when she was a baby because she was going to inherit, to like coming back and being labeled a papist witch, you know, so. Yeah, you don't have to know too much.
Yeah, when you were saying, because you know where it's going, I was like, what if some of us don't know where it's going?
Yes, so I'm going to tell you a very brief little story just to like why Please. I'm so obsessed with Mary Queen of Scots. When I was a wee child, I was sent off to Montessori school. I didn't speak perfect English at the time, but my parents had done a lot of work with me about, you know, whatever, school, learning numbers and stuff. So when I actually got to school in what would have been kindergarten, I got bumped up to like the next classroom up. So all the students were older than I was. And there was one girl in particular who was my nemesis for reasons I don't quite understand. But she was really mean to me from like the get-go. Oh,
no. And we Do had you still know her name?
Antoinette, wherever you are, girl. Like, it's going down. But were sitting down to like do reading time, and she was supposed to sort of mentor me, if you, whatever you want to call it, for that age, because I was still learning how to read. And she picked, I don't even know why this book was in elementary school, but it was like a picture book about royalty, I think. And she pointed to the picture of Mary Queen of Scots and is like, ugh, so like the parents you ended up with treated you well? And I said, what? And I looked at her and she's like, well, you know, your real mom. And I'm staring at her. She's like, well, you know, your real mom was Mary Queen of Scots. And then they cut off her head. So they had to give you to someone. And I went blank, like pale, took this information with me silently to the car ride home. And my mom is like, what's wrong with you? Because I'm on the brink of tears at age 5. And I keep it to myself.
Where's my
keep
real
it to
mom?
Myself. And then I blow up at her. I was like, where's my real mom? Like, and she's like, God. What on earth are you talking about? I was like, I know my real mom was Mary Queen of Scots. So,
Vanessa.
TLDR, my little Mexican self in Southern California who believed that a, you know, 14th, 15th century monarch was my real mother, has had a weird obsession with Mary Queen of Scots since. Like, I've just been, that's why I read so much stuff about that era.
Wow.
And now you know why.
I would not have guessed this story in a million years.
Yeah. And it is weirdly bookish because it was born from a book. But anyway, now you know it a little bit about me.
That is bananas. And you know, out of your great, you know, 5-year-old trauma, here we are.
Here we are. So, that's some of what I've been reading. What about you?
Well, I can pivot to childhood trauma also.
Yes. Take it away.
I just read The Exvangelicals by Sarah McCammon. Mm-hmm. She is an NPR reporter. She's on the political beat. She's on the campaign trail right now. But she grew up in suburban Kansas City, like 15 minutes from where I grew up. She went to an evangelical church that I knew that was like a few ticks more evangelical than the one that I did some time in high school. Longtime listeners of the show know, like, I was raised like mainline Methodist and then had a little field trip into evangelicalism for a little while.
What a field trip.
And yeah, a little excursion. And so McCammon's family was very conservative, very evangelical. She went to a private evangelical school. She was very, very sheltered. And then in high school, got an internship to be a page in the Senate or something like that. So in high school, spent several months living in Washington, D.C. with a bunch of other teenagers from all kinds of backgrounds. And that was really her first encounter with, you know, people of color, with people from different religious backgrounds, with people who identified as something other than heterosexual. And she bumps up against all of the things that she had been taught to believe about those people once she gets to know them in person. And that's like the beginning of the unraveling of her belief in the evangelical dogma, culture, whatever you want to call it. This is like her story is a microcosm of a much bigger thing. Exvangelicalism is like the name of a sub movement that's popped up online in the last several years of mostly like millennials and older Gen Zers who were raised in the evangelical church, either questioning or outright deconstructing their faith as they have, you know, grown up in a culture that is increasingly, you know, open and progressive around issues of race and issues of, you know, sexual identity, and they felt that conflict and have not been able to justify the closed-mindedness of the beliefs that they were raised with. So it's a mix of memoir and sort of broad reportage and sociology. She documents like the trend of this. She documents the ways that the evangelical church is shrinking. She documents the deep ties between evangelical churches and conservative political movements and how that looks different since Donald Trump than it looked in like the Reagan years and the early 90s. And she also interviews and speaks with a bunch of people who have left the evangelical movement for various but pretty similar reasons of finding that it doesn't actually align with what they believe to be right. I would have read this and been fascinated by it regardless. But when I was like, oh my God, we grew up like down the street from each other. I think she's a year older than me. My personal experience of it was just really wild that it like was very, very close to home. It's great. If that's something that you have any experience with that you're still making sense of from your childhood, I would definitely pick it up. Let's see. Still stay in the nonfiction zone, like a hard right turn, though. I also just listened to Sociopath by Patrick Gagné. Have you seen this?
No, actually, this is the only one I don't think I know anything about from your list.
Okay, so she is a diagnosed sociopath, a person who does not naturally feel empathy or guilt, that kind of thing. I think she's also about our age, like elder millennial, young Gen Xer, something like that. And it's her memoir of sort of coming to understand this about herself. When she was growing up, she knew that she felt this, like, she would feel this like itchiness, this increasing pressure or anxiety. And she would discover that it was relieved when she did things that she knew were bad and she got away with them. And it escalates the older that she gets, and she makes herself some rules. Like, some of this has a little bit of a Dexter flavor where she's like, I have a code, you know, like, I won't hurt people. I will only do things that, like, kind of are vigilante justice against people that are bad, or where I won't get caught, or where it's, you know, like a victimless crime, so to speak. She doesn't get diagnosed in childhood, but there's, like, you know, kind of constant disciplinary issues. Her parents are always frustrated with, like, why can't you just behave? She doesn't know what's going on with her. She doesn't know why she's different. It's like a very tangly experience. And as she's an adult, she takes a psychology class, and in Psych 101 is like, oh shit, I'm a sociopath.
This sounds familiar.
Right. Which, like, the most common thing in the world is for college freshmen to take Psych 101 and then, like, diagnose themselves with anything and everything. But she gets a legitimate diagnosis. She has a career working in the music industry. She's a music manager into her adulthood, and then eventually goes back to school to get a doctorate and become a therapist who treats sociopaths, because there is just, like, not enough. There's not a sufficient body of research about it. Nobody, like, wants to work with folks who have sociopathy, or they're scared of it. There's, you know, the way that she tells it is, like, this is something that's not represented very well in our cultural understanding of what this condition is. And that the distinction that she draws between sociopathy and psychopathy is that a sociopath can learn, you know, empathy and love and the learned emotions, the things that we have to be taught about by other people, where psychopaths, it seems like, are wired in a different way. So she's like, people can change. How can we help people so that they don't have to experience this? And she starts to understand that it's deeply connected to anxiety, to all sorts of other things for herself. Documents like early relationships, what this looks like in her marriage. The book ends as she is, you know, getting ready to start her new career as a therapist. And I was like, can you please keep going? All the childhood and young adulthood stuff is fascinating. This is, I think, important for people to tell these kinds of stories about their lives when they've got a diagnosis that is underexplored and misunderstood at best. But I would love a follow-up, I guess, about what her work and life have been like as she's, you know, continuing to understand what it means for herself, but also working with other people who identify or have been diagnosed as sociopaths. It was really, really interesting.
Fascinating. Like, both of these, I wrote them down.
It really was. It was great. And then kind of a surprise for me in fiction, you know, like, sometimes a book just seems to come out of nowhere, like you haven't heard anything about it, and then all of a sudden it's on, like, the Instagrams of 19 people whose taste you trust. And that is what happened to me with Great Expectations by Vincent Cunningham. It's a debut novel that just came out. First, that is a terrible title if you think about search engine optimization. I don't know what they
truly
were.
I gotta say, like, I thought I had to do a wellness check on you when I saw this title written down.
Like, yes, I have just discovered Charles Dickens and I have thoughts.
Frontless foyer, folks. Anyway, continue.
So Great Expectations by Vincent Cunningham. Cunningham writes for The New Yorker. He's been a theater critic there. He's done all kinds of interesting writing. But in 2008, he worked on Obama's presidential campaign. And this is autofiction about a young Black man who is working on the presidential campaign for an unnamed candidate. He's just called the candidate throughout the book, who kind of falls into a job with the campaign as a fundraiser, kind of courting high dollar rich people, and then helping them court their other high dollar rich people friends to try to raise money and host events to help the candidate first win the primaries and then go on to win the presidential election. He's like, that would be a fascinating debut novel by itself. But this character also was, you know, grew up in New York City, was raised in the church, sees a lot of parallels between the candidate's speaking style and some of the oratory of the church, and also just spends a lot of time reflecting on experiences that he had in the church, kind of tangling with his own understanding of morality, his evolving sense of himself, especially as he, who was not rich growing up, is learning how to try to like make a place for himself in this community of people that are campaigning for the candidate and are very wealthy. Like, how do you fit in? How do you make them trust you? And the tension that can exist between like the understanding of yourself as one way or one kind of person, and then now you're in a totally new situation, having to figure out what your identity is there. Mm-hmm. Really solid debut novel. I think it's going to be one of my fave debuts of the year. And I will say at first, I will not be surprised if we see this nominated like this for like the National Book Award. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised to see it on the long list. It's one of those debuts that has that kind of flavor to it. And that is how I ended up reading a book called Great Expectations in the year 2024. I will shout out that I'm in the middle of James by Percival Everett. I'm not going to say much about it because Jeff and I are doing a book club episode for the Patreon next week. So you can join us there, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. But like, I had some ideas about what a Percival Everett retelling of Huck Finn from the perspective of Jim, the enslaved man that spends the story with Huck, would be like. And they were turned on their head on page one.
Oh, wow.
Because that's how Percival Everett rolls. It's surprising and really interesting. I'm like, I have a whole bunch of Percival Everett profiles saved up to read afterwards, but I think he might be the most interesting man in the world. So that's going well. Oh, that's all. Yeah, it's really something. Also, talk about book award fodder for sure. Oh, and those are my updates. Any parting words, Vanessa? Where are the wheels on? Where, how are we doing?
I think the wheels are mostly on. We definitely covered a lot of ground, both news-wise and
we did
our picks, being distillations of who we are as people.
It's true.
Yeah. It was a good time.
It's been a while since we had a good front list foyer party on here, too. The last month or so, Jeff and I have been taking turns being out or being sick. There's work travel coming up in April, so y'all will hear other guest hosts in with me or with Jeff over the next month or so. But we're excited to be really in the season now of like big spring book releases, rolling towards what looks like a really promising rest of the year. So thanks for hanging with us this week. As always, you can find show notes at bookriot.com/listen. Join us at the Patreon, patreon.com/bookriotpodcast, for early ad-free listening and access to all of our bonus content. And of course, you can find me at Better Living Through Books. You can sign up for the Book Riot Podcast newsletter. All of that will be in the show notes as well. Vanessa, thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to go find myself a review copy of Oye.
Please do.
All right. Have a good one, y'all.